Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Do I need the microphone? Can you hear me without it? I need it. Okay. We'll use the microphone. Precious the rabbis, always wonderful to be with you. It's my favorite part of that bio was the way you ended it. Or the way I guess I ended it. I was once at a dinner and I met somebody who was not a member of the Orthodox community, and they asked me how many children I have. And when I told them, they looked at me puzzled and they said, "But you're not a Chabad rabbi, why do you have so many children?" Anyway, my real claim to fame and point of pride. So it's a pleasure to be with you this afternoon and to have the opportunity to address you on a topic that I know is near and dear to both you and me alike. And that is our commitment, our devotion, our love of the state of Israel, the land of Israel, and the people of Israel. I applaud you for your support and dedication to the school system of Israel, to Amit, to helping our brothers and sisters who are living the Jewish dream and the Jewish destiny in the Jewish homeland. Thank you for your efforts and for your commitment and for your generosity and for your support. And what I want to talk to you about might seem like a strange subject. The question is, must the state of Israel be in the land of Israel? Well, where else would it be, you might ask? Where else would you host it? Here in South Florida? Practically, you have so many Jews in South Florida. Should it be in the tri-state area? Where else would you have the state of Israel if not in the land of Israel? But what seems obvious to us was not always obvious. And even today is not obvious to everyone in the world. The recent UNESCO resolution, which the UN voted as if it's up to a vote, that there is no historical ties between the Jewish people, the Kotel, Har HaBayis, Yerushalayim, Yer HaKodesh, to these sections and these areas of our homeland. How refreshing it was yesterday to see a press conference in which the Prime Minister of Israel could unabashedly and with great pride talk about the historic connection and the permanent connection of the Jews to our homeland and to our eternal undivided city. But we have enemies who would still like to see us removed from that land and who seek on a regular basis to deny any connection. There was an article online several years ago on a website called Gawker.com. And the title of the article, and this was not satire, I wish it was. The title of the article was, "Israel should be in Germany." And listen to the thesis of this brilliant author, Hamilton Nolan. He writes, and I'm reading to you from the middle of the article, "What if when it was time to establish Israel, the land had instead been taken from people who did something wrong, from people who had in fact just got finished perpetrating one of history's greatest crimes against the Jewish people, the Nazis, the Holocaust? At the time Israel was being established, the Nazis had just been defeated. Germany was at the mercy of the Allies. What if instead of snatching land in the Middle East and setting the stage for perpetual war and hatred, what if the Jewish people had just been awarded, say, half of Germany? It's not like the Germans would have had a good case against it after what they just did. Give the Jews the best half of Germany. Give them Berlin. Give them the nice picturesque country villages and the thick forests. It would have been the least Germany could do." And the author goes on to try to persuade the audience that Israel should not have snatched and stolen land from the inhabitants who were there, but the state of Israel should have been set up instead in Germany. So it sounds like mind-boggling and impossible to us the state of Israel would be anywhere other than the land of Israel. There are those who would suggest it. Now, it might surprise you that long before this author on a website suggested Israel should be in Germany, Jews themselves, Zionists themselves, considered establishing the state of Israel outside the land of Israel. You're familiar with the history. There's a wonderful book called Jabotinsky, A Life, by Hillel Halkin. And I want to share with you what he writes in the book. When I first saw this, I was astonished. I knew the Uganda reference. But to see who supported that proposal, if you don't know, it's a good thing you're seated because you might fall off your chair. The Sixth Zionist Congress. The melody was changed without warning, he writes. Herzl's keynote address, Jabotinsky informed his readers, dropped a bombshell. The Yad HaRish plan had fallen through. The British government was now offering another territory in the well-watered, temperate highlands of East Africa, where Jews would be allowed to enjoy home rule as a British protectorate. So in other words, the Jews sought asylum, refuge. They wanted to establish a national homeland where they could develop their own culture, their own language. The British obviously occupied Israel, Palestine, our homeland, the time known as Palestine. You know, this past Hanukkah, my mother showed me for the first time, I had never seen it, my great-great-grandmother's menorah. My great-great-grandparents were among the founders of Neis Tziona in Israel. And it was a menorah that my own grandmother had inherited. And on the bottom of this beautiful silver menorah from a famous artist in Israel, whose name escapes me, it says, made in Palestine. Because my great-great-grandparents, the Palestinians, lit their menorah that was made in Palestine, because pre the establishment of the state, it was called Palestine, and the Jews living there were the real original Palestinians. So the British occupied the land, the Jews, as we all are familiar, through the efforts of Etzel, Lehi, the Haganah, coordinated and most often uncoordinated efforts to overthrow and to push the British out. And the British had proposed one plan, the El Arish plan, it fell through, and now they came with another proposal. This highlands of East Africa. Given the urgent need to provide Eastern European Jewry with a reliable asylum, Herzl favored accepting the proposal as long as Palestine, quote, the land of our forefathers, remained the ultimate goal. So maybe an intermediary step would be, we could establish sovereignty, we could establish a government, we could establish a state elsewhere, as long as we never lose focus and never lose our aspiration for the final destination of Israel. As a first step, he was asking the delegates to appoint a committee to investigate the prospects and to report back. The British offer, although apparently referring to an area in northwest Kenya near Lake Victoria, it immediately became known as the Uganda Plan. It's fascinating how history became full circle with Entebbe and the raid in Entebbe, Uganda near Lake Victoria, and so on. It was a sensational breakthrough for political Zionism. Right? From our perspective, historically, reflecting back, we say, what a preposterous proposal. Who would have possibly considered it? There is no alternative to our homeland, to the land of Israel itself. And yet, at the Sixth Zionist Congress, it wasn't a preposterous proposal. It was a celebrated breakthrough. How extraordinary that just 6 years after the movement's founded, it was being granted an opportunity to establish a semi-independent Jewish polity under the aegis of a major European power. After 2,000 years of exile, 2,000 years of targeted oppression, persecution, attempted extermination, after a mere 6 years of Zionism being an organized effort, they were being offered a semi-state. It was something, from their perspective and at their time, worthy of consideration. Yet it was a breakthrough with agonizing implication, for Herzl's Palestine proviso could hardly be taken seriously. Unlike El Arish, from which an expansion of Jewish settlement into nearby Palestine was imaginable, East Africa was thousands of miles away. The enormous investment of time, money, and human resources needed for developing an autonomous Jewish region there clearly precluded a similar effort elsewhere. In other words, the more you were putting into establishing yourself in Uganda, the more it would take away, which might be why it was offered, from efforts to permanently establish yourself in Palestine, in the land of Israel. I'm going to skip ahead, but I highly recommend this interesting book, because this is the part that you'll be fascinated by. A show of hands, which he expected to win easily, was what Herzl wanted, and a bitter debate was what he got. A majority of the Western Europeans again supported Herzl. Most of them conceived of a Jewish state more as a place of refuge for their persecuted brethren than as an expression of Jewish national and cultural aspirations. And a well-disposed British protectorate in Africa seemed no worse an option than a hostile Turkish Palestine. So for most of these secular Zionists, Zionism was not about anything intrinsic or inherent in the land itself, any sanctity of the land, the fulfillment of a biblical promise of return to where it all began. It was simply strategic. The Jews were persecuted. Exile was harsh, had left utter destruction in its wake. Europe was a Jewish graveyard. And an opportunity to establish sovereignty anywhere provided the refuge that they sought through Zionism. You can understand why some of the early and even continued harsh resistance and protest objection to Zionism by the religious community, when you understand that at the root of some secular Zionism was not about religion, Torah, the promise of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Bris Ben HaBasar, was not about a religious realization, but was about a technical place of refuge. The Eastern European vote was more divided and more paradoxical. Are you ready? This is the part that's shocking. The Mizrahi, the religious Zionists, how do you think they voted on the Uganda proposal? They voted with Herzl. They voted for the plan. Under attack by the anti-Zionist Orthodox establishment, why did they vote for it? It's fascinating. Under attack from the anti-Zionist Orthodox establishment for supporting a Jewish return to the land of Israel without divine sanction, it sought to demonstrate that it was motivated solely by a desire to relieve Jewish suffering that was untainted by messianic fantasies. Because they were always looking over their shoulder. You know, outside the White House press conference yesterday, where the Prime Minister of Israel proudly talked about the Jewish state in front of the world stage, I don't know if any of you saw the horrific image, which is so sad. And thank God it's only a handful of Nature Karta were protesting with banners. Protesting the Prime Minister of Israel. You don't represent Israel. You don't represent Judaism. We don't belong there. Give up the land. Hashem Yirachem. The image. So the religious Zionist was always looking over their shoulder at the anti-religious. And the early Mizrahi were trying to prove, you know what, for us it's not about messianic fantasies. It's about that technical aspiration of a place of refuge to save Jews who are being persecuted and chased. So shockingly, from our perspective, the Mizrahi, the religious Zionists, voted with Herzl in favor of the Uganda plan. Who voted against it? Why did it fall? Why do we go visit the land of Israel, not the state of Israel in Uganda today? Who voted against it? It was the secular Zionists. Nearly all the secular Zionists of the Democratic faction, on the other hand, were fiercely opposed, products of the shtetl and its values. Even after having revolted against them, they could not imagine a Jewish homeland that was not the land Jews always had longed for. Who saved the day? Not the Mizrahi, who went with Herzl. It was the secular Zionists, many of whom had left religious upbringings, who the sounds of the cheder continued to echo in their ears, could never have abandoned the longing to return to the land of Israel for a place in Africa. And so, they took a vote on the fourth day of the Congress. 295 delegates voted in favor, 176 against, 143 abstained. So even though it passed, the margin was so small that Herzl did not go with it. So what I want to talk to you about in the remaining time I have left between now and Shabbos, it won't be that long, but I want to talk about why the secular Zionists were right and why the Mizrahi were wrong. Why there is no alternative for the state of Israel other than the land of Israel. Why the realization of our dream is not just to have sovereignty, it's not just to have autonomy, it's not just to become some secular political entity, but rather is the fulfillment of a promise from HaKadosh Baruch Hu that could not be realized anywhere but the land of Israel. That the land, the earth, the soil is categorically different than the soil and the earth anywhere else in the world. That the air and the atmosphere in the land of Israel is unlike air and atmosphere anywhere else in the world. That it is a singular place on earth. It is the place where the whole world was created from. It's the place where it all began. It's the place where our people were promised that we would be that light unto nation, that we would fulfill HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Almighty's divine plans for his world. The Ramban, in his commentary throughout Torah, makes numerous references to the intrinsic sanctity of the land of Israel, to the special quality of the land of Israel. And in fact, the Ramban goes so far, it's referencing a Gemara, but the Ramban records a statement that is not only so incredibly bold, but which is an indictment of every one of us at this Amit luncheon here in magnificent Boca Raton, Florida. And I share it with you not with pride from the podium, but sharing in our collective indictment and calling all of us to constantly be reflecting and considering where we ultimately belong, and not if, but when we will move to the great state of Israel and land of Israel and just come here in the winter in Boca like everybody else. The Ramban writes, Hadar b'chutz la'aretz doma k'mi she'en lo eloka she'nemar ki gershuni ayom mi'amistafei p'nachlas Hashem le'mor lach avor Elohim achirim. Says the Ramban, we have a tradition. If you live outside the land of Israel, it is as if you have no God. You have abandoned the Almighty and His design for the world and for your world and for your life. Shechina, the presence of the Master of the Universe, can be perceived and felt more intensely in Israel than anywhere else. Outside the land of Israel, we connect through God through intermediary. It's a long-distance call. It's dial-up internet. Only in the land of Israel is that level of access, is that level of connection, is the high speed and the HD quality palpable in the air. The Ramban means it not only as an agadic statement, because the Ramban goes further and makes an even more incredibly bold statement. It says, the performance of mitzvos outside the land of Israel are simply practice. You know why you made a bracha before you ate this lunch and you're going to bench at its conclusion? You know why you're going to light candles tomorrow night and we're going to observe Shabbos? You know why men put on tefillin this morning and we opened the siddur and we davened? Of course, there's intrinsic value to all those activities and behaviors. But the reason we're doing it here in Boca is to condition ourselves to create the habit and the familiarity so that when we make it to Israel, where it really matters and where it really counts, we'll know what we're doing. Israel's the Super Bowl, the big game. Here, this is practice. We're practicing. Don't skip a practice. Practice is mandatory. The Ramban doesn't make his comment so that we feel less obligated to fulfill mitzvos, so that we can feel more casual. We can negotiate with mitzvos. No, practice is mandatory. Practice is obligatory. It's non-negotiable. But never ever confuse a scrimmage and practice for the big game, for the real thing. Only in Israel are mitzvos fulfilled most authentically, in the most real fashion. Outside the land of Israel, one is conditioning themselves, one is developing familiarity, one is practicing. And Ramban goes on and on in his commentary, I'm not going to take the time now, but about the great sanctity and the great holiness and the atmosphere of Eretz Yisrael, the Kedusha, that's palpable, that's perceivable there. Others pick up on it. Great Rishonim and Achronim. The Kaftor Beferach, Rabbi Shtori Aparchi, writes, he lived in the 13th, early 14th century, about the intrinsic auspiciousness of the land of Israel. That not just homiletically speaking, but those struggling with infertility go to Israel, visit Israel, spend time in Israel, because the atmosphere of Israel is more auspicious, it's more blessed, it more lends itself to accessing and drawing great blessing. The Tashbeitz, Rav Shimon ben Tzemach Duran, in the 14th and early 15th century, also speaks similarly about the skula, not some fake skula, the red bendel, that's a skula for the person selling you the red bendel on the steps to enter the kotel. Not some fake counterfeit skula. We've exchanged real opportunities for skulas with fake ones. We have skula. We're an am segula. Real skula, Torah and mitzvos. God said, I'm giving you 613 skulas. You know, last week everyone was reading Parshas Haman. Tuesday, if you read the Parshas Haman, the Aliyah of the day, then you're guaranteed a parnasa. You know what the best skula for parnasa is? Having a job. Tried, tested, true. Of course, if you're reading Parshas Haman, and that is increasing your sense of emunah, that everything is from Hashem, and just as the man miraculously fell when it was needed, so too all that we need, Hashem will provide. If it's increasing emunah, beautiful. More power to you. But if you think you can mumble words that you don't even know what they mean, and that somehow mystically and magically and heebie-jeebie, you're going to have a parnasa, your grandson's going to, your son-in-law will finally have a parnasa, whatever you think is going to happen because you mumbled Parshas Haman, the Reb Bendel won't help. The Tosefta calls it Darchei Amori, the Parshas Haman. We have schools. So our Rishonim and Achronim talk, one of those schools is the land of Israel. Everything about the Torah defines that our peoplehood, our national identity is grounded. Our agricultural cycles, the holiday experiences that commemorate history, all are centered around Eretz Yisrael. The specialness of the land. God didn't choose it in a random fashion. It wasn't by chance. It's the very place from which the world began. Rabbi Soloveitchik writes, and this appears in his the work, The Emergence of Ethical Man. Rabbi Soloveitchik writes, the closeness of man and God is confined to a specific environment in spite of both divine universality and ubiquity and the effort of man to transcend his limitedness and finitude. That's Rabbi Soloveitchik speak. I'll tell you what that means in a moment. The encounter of God and man is conditioned by certain external factors. The first appearance of God to Avraham, as recorded in the Torah, was associated with the command of Lech Lecha, go forth, of emigrating from his father's home to the land of Israel. Avram, acting under God's orders, arrived in Canaan. God promised to an agreement with Avram were subject to the fulfillment of the above-mentioned command. All of the rest of the story of our people being born and our mission in this world are predicated on that first test. Go to the land. That's where it's all supposed to happen. Why God could not enter into an intimate relationship with Avram in Mesopotamia and had to guide him into a new land is an old problem. Wonders the Rav, God is omnipotent, he's infinite. Can't God forge this special relationship with Avram in Boca, in LA, in Detroit, Chicago, in Teaneck, in Paris, in London, in Australia, in South Africa? Why did it have, Shem tells Avram, I got big plans for us. I have a big plan for us. It's going to be unbelievable. We're going to transform the world together. We're going to repair the world. We're going to perfect the world together. Your children are going to be my children, my people. And you're going to teach the world values. But before we can do any of that, the big plan, follow me. I need you to come with me. I can only reveal the plan. We can only put the plan into action in the land of Israel, in Canaan. And wonders the Rav, why? Why couldn't they have this conversation in Mesopotamia? Why couldn't God charge Avram with this mission there? Yehuda Alevi in his Kuzari explains it with uniqueness of the land of Israel as an ideal land for the meeting of God by man. He attributes metaphysical qualities to the land, endows it with a spiritual climate. The air of your land is the breath of life for our souls, writes Yehuda Alevi in Sion Halo Tishali, that we're all familiar with as one of the kinos of Tisha B'Av. Of course, the old myth of the temperate climate, which is ideal for the development of man, was exploited by Halevi. The Ramban and his commentary followed in Halevi's footsteps, as did the mystics. For them, the attribute of Kedusha, holiness, ascribed to the land of Israel, is an objective metaphysical quality inherent in the land. So for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, the Ramban and others, what the Rav categorizes as the mystics, the uniqueness, the specialness of Israel is the inherent holiness, that it is categorically different by design, intrinsically, than anywhere else on earth. But continues the Rav, with all my respect for the Rishonim, I must disagree with such an opinion. You have to be the Rav to say that. I do not believe that it is halachically cogent. Kedusha, under a halachic aspect, is man-made. More accurately, it is a historical category. A soil is sanctified by historical deeds performed by a sacred people, never by any primordial superiority. The halachic term Kedusha Sa'aretz, the sanctity of the land, denotes the consequence of human act, either conquest or the mere presence of the people in the land. Kedusha is identical with man's association with Mother Earth. Nothing could be attributed a priori to dead matter. Objective Kedusha smacks of fetishism. The Rav says, unlike the mystics, that the special quality of Israel is not inherent, is not intrinsic, is not inborn, didn't exist misheshes yimebreshes from the time of the creation itself. Said the Rav, the special sanctity of Israel, like all sanctity, is man-made. Because when the Jewish people came to Israel, when they showed the courage and the bravery, when we forged our national destiny, when we aligned ourselves with God, Lech Tech Acharai Bamidbar, that created the Kedusha, man-made. I believe, said the Rav, rather than divine commandment to Abraham to leave his parents' land and go to the land of Canaan, should be understood under a different aspect entirely. The charismatic personality must disassociate himself from his natural connections and completely free himself from the environment he was born and reared in. The chosen person severs his affiliation with his clan and friends. He deserts everybody in order to give himself up to his new friend, God. In other words, the Kedusha of the land of Israel is the result of the courage that Avram showed in disassociating, in disconnecting, in giving up prominence and prestige, in wiping himself to be a clean slate, ready and open to hear anything that God would tell him. That act of bravery and of courage that Avram displayed, that was the necessary prerequisite before God would reveal the master plan of what they would accomplish together. Before Hashem was ready to tap Avram as the Av Hamon Goyim, as the father of all nations, Avram first had to show that he was not too connected, too formed, too loyal to an existing culture or thought process or belief system. He had to divorce himself from it. And only after Lech Lecha could God tap Avram to fulfill that mission. And through that courage, that's the Kedusha of the land. The sanctity, the specialness of Israel results from the courage that Avram was willing to say that he is an Ivri, in the words of the new great song by Benny Friedman. Ivri Anochi. I am an Ivri. Me'iver. The whole world could be on that side. I am Me'iver. The whole world thinks that's ethical, that's moral, that's the Jewish connection or lack of it to the homeland. The whole world thinks this, that, or the other. Avram had the courage to stand Me'iver. He was an Ivri. He stood on the other side. He divorced Lech Lecha, Me'artzecha, Me'moladetcha, Me'beis Avicha. He was willing to disassociate from all of that and to only associate with the divine will, with the divine plan. That is the hallmark of our people. That planted the seeds of Kedusha, of sanctity. Said the Rav, it's not mystical, it's not inherent, it's not intrinsic, it's not auspicious, it's not a skula. Said the Rav, it's when we show the courage to be defined in our worldview, in our thinking, in our lifestyle, in our values, we create Kedusha. The Rav doesn't write it here, but he writes it elsewhere. And it's a fantastic insight and perfect for this week's parsha. By a show of hands, how many people here have visited Har Sinai? Har Sinai is debated exactly where it is, what it is. Can you go there? What's Har Sinai? Torah is given at Har Sinai. Torah is bestowed on the Jewish people. Har Sinai is forgotten. It was a moment in time. It's not forgotten that we'll all stand when we listen to the Torah reading this week's parsha and remember the giving of the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, Aseres Adibros. But there are no Jewish missions, Federation missions, trips to Har Sinai. How many have been to the Kotel by a show of hands? Stood at the base of Har Habayis? Maybe some have been on Har Habayis, on the Temple Mount. So why is it none of you have been to Har Sinai? We've all been to Har Habayis. What's the difference between Har Sinai and Har Hamoria? And the Rav had a brilliant insight. Said the Rav along the same lines of what I just read to you, but he said it elsewhere. Har Sinai was God talking to man. Har Hamoria is man talking to God. When God talks to man, that is a special moment. It's a seminal moment in all of human history. It changed the world, the giving of the Torah. But the moment it's done, it dissipates, it disappears, it's over. God visited his countenance on that place. He deposited what he needed to deposit. And when he leaves, there is no residual effect. But Har HaMoriah, Har HaBayis, the Temple Mount, where Jewish people brought korbanos, offered sacrifices, opened their hearts, offered prayers, turned to God, transformed their lives. Every year repented on Yom Kippur, did tshuva, and repaired their way. Har HaMoriah, the mountain that captured not God to the Jewish people, but the Jewish people to God. That's Kidsha L'Shaita L'Asid Lavo. That sanctity is permanent. It lasts. It transformed that place forever. Because Kedusha is not something mystical and innate. It is the result of our actions and our behavior. The land of Israel is a singular place. The Rav writes elsewhere in Reflections of the Rav. He says, the word singular means being only one, exceptional, extraordinary, separate. The word segula in Hebrew similarly connotes singularity. In Shemos, the Torah enunciates the doctrine of the election of Israel as a cardinal tenet of our faith. And you shall be to me segula from all other people. Hashem charges us, we're supposed to be an Am Segula, not a superstitious people chasing after counterfeit, fake, ridiculous segulas, but an Am Segula. What does it mean? The word Segula is interpreted by Rashi as referring to a cherished treasure comparable to costly vessels and precious stones for which a king has a special regard. Segula may also describe relationships between people. Yaakov loved Rachel, but he did not hate Leah, despite the pasuk that says, and the Eternal saw that Leah was unloved, snu'ah. His bond to her merely suffered by comparison, because he loved Rachel more than Leah. He had no reason to feel any animosity toward her, but his relationship with Rachel was singular, exceptional, unique. Similarly, Yaakov loved Yosef and Binyamin, Rachel's children, differently than he loved his other sons. Yehuda described this succinctly. Right, it says in Bereshis, Yaakov's soul, nafsho kshura b'nafsho. There was a school of dimension in these special loves. It involved an intertwining of souls, a union beyond verbal description. It was more than an emotional love. It was a oneness, which is the highest rung of identification. A school of love is an ontological merger. It's a great Ravism. A school of love is an ontological merger. It means it's a metaphysical, existential merger. It's not just, you know, anniversary card. It's not just a gift. It's not just I love you. It is something transcendent. Similarly, the people of Israel are a school of people, singularly valued by Hashem. It involves no denigration of other nations. It is a specialness, a nation one of its kind, which God has designated to preserve and disseminate His divine teachings. Now the Rav comes to Israel. A school of people inhabits a school of land. It is a land which the Eternal your God looks after, on which the Lord your God always keeps his eye. Mereish shara ad achrish shara. Rashi adds, although God cares for other lands, his relationship with Eretz Yisrael is special. Jewish destiny is linked with this land. We have no other. Only in this land, Chazal say, does the Shechina dwell. Only therein does prophecy flourish. You know, there is no nevuah outside the land of Israel. This skula attribute of the land is no more rationally explicable than the skula of the people. These are qualities certified by our faith, and history has corroborated the singularity of both people and land. So whatever makes us different than others, which is a topic for another time, do we believe the Jewish people are inherently or intrinsically different? Or are we different only by virtue of our being charged with a mission? Are we intrinsically different? Some might argue even superior. There are strains within our own tradition, our own rabbinic tradition. Or are no, we're not inherently any different or superior, but because we've been charged with a mission, we are singular. And what the Rav is saying is, whatever creates and defines the singularity of our people is true for the singularity of the land. The mission is to be fulfilled in the land. There's a triumvirate. The people of Israel, the Torah of Israel, being lived where? Only in the land of Israel. The singularity of our people. And this is what Tzion means. A Tzion is a landmark. It's a flag. It designates a place. It's from there that we are to teach the entire world to have that impact. My friends, we as Jews, wherever we're living for whatever reason, and there are legitimate reasons to live outside the land of Israel, despite what our Aliyah snob friends and family say, there are legitimate reasons to live outside the land of Israel. All you have to do is learn Daf Yomi every day, and you see the conversations between the rabbis of Babylonia and of Israel, traveled back and forth and communicated back and forth, and unless anyone's willing to indict all of them, there are legitimate reasons. There are. It doesn't mean everyone has that legitimate reason, but there are legitimate reasons. But there's no legitimate reason to not be always thinking about Israel. Having Israel center in our prayers, in our thoughts, in our concerns, in our commitment, in our resources, in our priorities, in our vacations, in our considerations about where we will live and where we will grow old and how we will spend our leisure time. Pasuk says in Yirmiyahu in the 30th chapter, Ki ha'ale aruch alach u'mimakosayach erpa'ech nu'um Hashem ki nidacha karu lach tzion hi doresh ein la. I'll make a cure for you, I'll hear you from your wounds, the word of Hashem. They call you discarded. They say about you, she is tzion, ein doresh, doresh ein la. No one cares about her. She's neglected. She's forgotten. Nobody cares. The Radak writes, Umos ha'olam amru ki tzion hi ir she'en la doresh lashiv al Yisrael. Who is Yirmiyahu HaNavi talking about? Who is he describing? Says the Radak, he's describing the nations of the world who say, you know, the Jewish people, they don't talk about Israel, they don't give to Israel, they don't care about Israel, they don't lobby for Israel, they don't advocate for Israel. So why should we care about Israel? Doresh ein la. And from here, the Gemara in Sukkah, Daf Memalov concludes, Tzion hi doresh ein la, michlal debayadrisha. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai taught that from the fact that Yirmiyahu laments that people have neglected, they have forgotten, they have confused the comfort of where they're living with caring about the center capital of the Jewish people, doresh ein la, they have forgotten, michlal debayadrisha, that there is a mitzvah to always be doresh, to inquire, to think about. When I wake up in the morning and I look at my phone and I want to see what's happening, the very first thing I do every day, the first thing I do, I open the app on my phone for the Times of Israel. It's the first thing on my mind. God forbid, has anything bad happened in Israel? Is there anything new coming out of Israel? What's happening in Israel? The last thing I do before I fall asleep at night, you see, I have a problem with technology and addiction. But the last thing I do, Times of Israel app. What's going on in Israel? Anything new out of Israel? God forbid, has something bad happened in Israel? Michlal debay drisha. We can't forget wherever we are living and whatever is happening. In fact, this informs halacha. And I'm out of time, so I'm going to end. But this informs our own halachic practices. There are things that we do. The fact that we take a lulav and esrog for a whole week rather than one day is only to commemorate the way it used to happen in the Beis HaMikdash. Beis Soloveitchik noted that we have two types of practices. We have zecher lemikdash and we have zecher lechurban. Some things we do commemorate the destruction, remind us that we're living in exile, metaphysical exile still. So, the breaking of the glass at a wedding and leaving part of your home unplastered, tearing kriya when you visit the kotel. There are numerous practices that are zecher lechurban. They commemorate the destruction. But we also have practices that are zecher lemikdash, that we are supposed to be doresh tzion. You know, in the temple times, the only place that the lulav and esrog were taken for a whole week was at the Beis HaMikdash. The gvulin outside the Beis HaMikdash, it was only taken the first day. Why do we take it all week long? It was instituted zecher lemikdash, that we not stop forgetting. So within our own ritual practice, the general halachic observance, and the Rav made an argument that we count Sfiras HaOmer today, zecher lemikdash. The reason we count both days and weeks, and the way we count, and I don't want to scare you by telling you that Pesach's coming up, and it's followed by Sfiras HaOmer. But the Rav argued that Sfiras HaOmer itself is a fulfillment of this idea of being Doresh Tzion, of always remembering the way it was and what it's about. I want to leave you with one last thought. It comes from an incredible author, Rav Yisachar Shlomo Taiftal. Anyone ever heard of him? He wrote a book called Eim Habanim Smicha. He lived from 1885 to 1945. Who was he? He was a Hungarian Jew, a Hasidish Talmud Chacham, a virulently anti-Zionist Orthodox Jew, devout Orthodox Jew. And then the Nazis came to power, and the Holocaust struck. And in the darkness and the bleakness, in the dungeon of the ghetto and in the concentration camp, the great Eim Habanim Smicha, the great Rabbi Yisachar Shlomo Taiftal, began to reconsider all that he had learned and all that he had thought and all that he had espoused regarding the Jews returning to the land of Israel and setting up a state of Israel. And he did an entire 180 in about face. And he wrote a work, Eim Habanim Smicha. It's available now. It's been translated multiple times into English. If you haven't read it, you must read it. Because this Hasidish Yid, this incredible Talmud Chacham, who was among the most virulent anti-Zionists, became an incredible spokesperson, an articulate, compelling, persuasive argument for religious Zionism in his Eim Habanim Smicha. The most remarkable thing about the book is he wrote it on the run, while being persecuted, while in hiding, while tortured, with no access to Sfarim, and you see what a Talmud Chacham he is by the breadth and width of what he quotes, the encyclopedic knowledge that he had. An extraordinary person, an extraordinary read. And in his Eim Habanim Smicha, I'll read it to you in the English. He says the following. After I've explained with God's help that the redemption for which we so fervently yearn will occur gradually, step by step, we can understand the comment found in the Drashos Bechsam Sofer. He infers from the Rambam that Israel will gather together in Eretz Yisrael before the advent of Mashiach, even though the Beis HaMikdash is still not yet rebuilt. He's trying to make the whole argument for returning to the land and for setting up our state and for bringing Mass Aliyah, and that all this precedes Mashiach, not after it, as had been taught and advocated earlier on. But listen to what he says a little bit later. It's an incredible quote. He writes, quote, "Now even though all of Israel will not return right away," how many Jews live outside the land of Israel? 6 million, 7 million? "Even though all of Israel will not return right away, it seems to me that the land will become a universal center for the entire Jewish nation by the very fact that there will be an assembly of Jews in Yerushalayim and Eretz Yisrael. Even those who remain in the diaspora will keep their eyes and hearts on the land. They will be bound and connected with all their souls to the universal center which will be established in Eretz Yisrael. It will unite them even in the diaspora, and they will not be considered dispersed at all." So presciently, so prophetically, writing during the horrors of the Holocaust. This is not an article on Times of Israel in 2017. He's writing it as the Jewish people are being annihilated. And with a sense of hope and optimism and promise, with a tinge of prophecy, he describes there will be a day soon when even though all Jews will not live in Israel, Israel will be on all Jews' minds. And that kibbutz galuyos, the ingathering of the exiles, is achieved not only when geographically or physically we are all in Israel, but there is an element of kibbutz galuyos when Jews in Boca wake up and press the Times of Israel app. When Jews in Boca go on the news and see what's happening in Israel. When Jews in Boca order something online because it was made in Israel. When Jews in Boca call their friends and family, text and email. When Jews in Israel book their vacation not to exotic places on earth, but only to Israel. That even those not yet living in Israel are part of the collection of the diaspora. When we turn our hearts and our attention, our resources and our devotion to Israel. It's not a complete realization of kibbutz galuyos, but it is the beginning of the fulfillment of that promise. So I end the way I began, with admiration to you for your commitment and devotion to furthering the projects of Amit in Israel, and helping support our brothers and sisters in the development and education there, and with the plea that we all, in a bracha, and a hope, and a prayer, that we all are able to realize the dream to live in Israel, to fulfill the promise of the Jewish people, to welcome the end of days, and Mashiach will bring with him peace, real, lasting peace that we so desperately yearn for. And that until that day, wherever we are in the world, that our heart and our attention, that we are always Doresh Tzion, that Israel is on our minds wherever we are. Thank you so much.